to, that it is in their self-interest to make these changes as fast as possible. And let me just say, in fairness to China, that historically...
We have 15 seconds to end.
Oh, okay. So I think now is the time for action. We must evaluate the summit not in terms of vague promises. We need to see what the implementation plan, and they need to be checked in Glasgow to make sure that this was just not another talk shop. Thank you.
Kumi Naidoo, I want to thank you for being with us, Special Advisor for the Green Economy Coalition's Social Contract Initiative, former head of Amnesty International and Greenpeace, and Dipti Bhatnagar of Friends of the Earth International. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe. Wear a mask.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Development and Events Committee meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is supported by our members and by the Columbia SLU Watershed Council's SLU DIY House Party, an excuse to let loose. An online benefit on Friday, April 23rd, with live music from Wren, the Matisse's Latin Ensemble, and DJ Mr. Mom. Tickets and more information can be found at columbiaslu.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a fourth wave of COVID-19 has hit, and Oregon is suffering one of the worst spikes in the country. Multnomah County announces the largest budget in its history. And Portland introduces a renter-landlord mediation program. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, April 23rd, 2021. I'm Nat Moon. Yesterday, the Oregon Health Authority announced 989 cases of COVID-19, the highest daily total since mid-January. Six more people died, and the OHA reported that last week, cases rose by 20% for the fourth straight week. Today, in her weekly coronavirus update, Oregon Governor Kate Brown said that variants are growing faster than the state's vaccination rate, and a fourth wave of infections has begun.
Today's cases topped 1,000, with Oregon now ranking second in the nation for having the most rapid growth of infections spread. Our doctors and nurses are once again overwhelmed. Our hospitals are about to surpass 300 patients who are positive for COVID-19, crossing the threshold to place several of our counties into extreme risk. Unfortunately, that means at least 12 counties are on the verge of having to reinstate restrictions on businesses like restaurants, bars, and gyms, and to limit social gatherings to very small groups again. The overwhelming majority of our new COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations are people who have not yet been vaccinated. We are seeing younger Oregonians in the hospital now, as well as people who had no underlying health conditions.
Brown took the opportunity to highlight her 10-point plan for economic recovery and her reports to pass business and worker relief bills during this legislative session. She said that her objective was to lift the pandemic restrictions by summer and outlined the steps she feels are required to achieve that goal.
Here's what must happen before we are able to fully reopen our economy. Oregonians need to get vaccinated. We need to reach a significant majority of Oregonians with a vaccine. We need to close the equity gap in our vaccine efforts. And vaccine supplies need to be readily available for all eligible Oregonians who want to be protected. Most importantly, and of grave concern right now, we need adequate hospital staffing and capacity for our families and friends in need of this care. Vaccines are the absolute key to moving Oregon forward. I do think, with all of us working together, that we can get to a place where we lift most restrictions and fully reopen our economy no later than the end of June. Common sense safety measures like mask wearing and maintaining 6 feet of distance will need to stay in place. We will all need to make smart choices over the next several weeks so that we can move forward and into post-pandemic life.
Nationwide, vaccines are available to all individuals over the age of 16. As of today, about 40% of Oregonians have received at least one dose, and 26% are fully vaccinated. At least two Oregon colleges have announced that they will require proof of COVID-19 vaccination for all students this fall. On Wednesday, Lewis and Clark College notified students that they must be fully vaccinated or have an approved exemption by October 15th. The requirement does not apply to students who are fully online. Also on Wednesday, Willamette University confirmed that they too would require students and staff to get vaccinated for the fall semester. This requirement applies even if an individual has already had COVID-19, but exceptions may be made for those who cannot get the shot due to medical or religious reasons. Lewis and Clark and Willamette may be the first two schools to require vaccination to return to campus, but it's expected that most of the colleges in the state will follow their lead. Yesterday, Multnomah County Chair Deborah Kafuri announced that the county will consider the largest budget in its history. The proposed budget comes to $2.81 billion and includes $78 million from the recently passed American Rescue Plan, as well as funding from several recently approved ballot measures. Kafuri said the federal money would be primarily focused on public health, saying, quote, "We're still very much in this fight against COVID. With case numbers going back up, we know we have a lot of work to do." The board is also planning to begin spending money from the three county ballot measures that passed last year. Those funds become available July 1st and include the county's Preschool for All measure, Metro's supportive housing measure, and the county's bond to improve and expand library access. $52 million in supportive housing funds will be used to help 1,300 people currently experiencing houselessness get housing. $60 million will be allocated to the launch of the Multnomah County's Universal Preschool Program. The goal this year is to begin training childcare workers and getting facilities up and running, with an eye to get kids into classrooms in coming years. Yesterday's acceptance of the budget by the county board starts a 6-week process that will include two public hearings. County commissioners will vote on the final budget in early June. On Wednesday, the Portland City Council approved funding to launch a pilot mediation program aimed at preventing some renters and landlords from going to court over eviction disputes. The vote came just prior to a potential flood of evictions as the state's COVID-19 eviction moratorium expires. A contract with Portland-based nonprofit Resolutions Northwest was unanimously approved, and $150,000 was allotted for the initial program. The money will pay for a mediator in disputes, and in some cases will provide rent assistance and additional financial aid. During Wednesday's council meeting, Commissioner Dan Ryan stressed that the program was urgently needed by both renters and landlords. Ryan oversees the city's housing bureau. In its pilot phase, the mediation program could assist in resolving from 70 to 100 renter-landlord disputes, where residents are at risk of losing their housing. Roughly half of the allotted funds will be made available as financial assistance going towards back rent and possibly towards overdue utility and property damage as agreements are made between both parties. Commissioner Joanne Hardesty urged a note of caution about the actual impact the pilot program may have. Hardesty called out the possibility of 100 mediations and said, quote, "I just don't want to overpromise a pilot project like this, knowing the magnitude of need out there." Researchers say that there is often a breakdown in communication in renter-landlord disputes, and that mediation can help prevent expensive legal battles that neither party is interested in. The city has not established a concrete start date for the program, although it is likely a public engagement process to alert interested tenants and landlords to the new program will get the ball rolling. In an apparent effort to limit the potential number of GOP walkouts, Oregon House Democrats are looking to combine two separate gun bills into a single piece of legislation. On Wednesday, the House Rules Committee indicated their intention to combine Senate Bill 554 with House Bill 2510. As originally written, SB 554 would allow local governments to ban holders of concealed weapons permits from bringing guns into public buildings. The bill has already been approved in the Senate. House Bill 2510 requires gun owners to secure their weapons when not in use, either with trigger locks or by placing them in a locked container. It also requires owners of stolen guns to immediately report the thefts to law enforcement. If the plan works, the House will approve the combined bill and send it back to the Senate for a revote. This would reduce the number of times Republican senators could walk out or deploy parliamentary procedures to slow down the vote. But in the process of combining the two bills, the original SB 544 was watered down. The revised version would limit the right to restrict guns to universities, colleges, and public schools, and the state capitol, but other state or local agencies would simply not have that option. Chief sponsor Senator Jenny Burdick, Democrat of Portland, was not pleased, saying the revisions went way too far in weakening the bill. But even with the modifications, it was unclear what the Republican response would be when it comes time for a vote. Republican Representative Lily Morgan of Grants Pass said, quote, "I want my constituents to feel safe and know that they have a speedy, reliable access to their firearms in an emergency." A group in Gresham is working to push the city to purchase a plot of land adjacent to Grant Butte Park before a developer adds 30 homes to the forested wetland. KBOO's Althea Billings has more on the story.
Neighbors in the Centennial area of Gresham are pushing the city to save a piece of wetland and forest property from development. It's referred to as the Shaw property, and it was originally part of a larger farm that became Grant Butte Park. The majority of the land was turned into a park by the city when its former owner passed away. His second wife lived on the Shaw property until her passing and expressed in her will that the city of Gresham would have the right to buy the property at a 10% discount of $900,000 and add it to the existing park. But due to some missteps, the property was bought in December by a developer who now says he will sell it back to the city for $2.5 million or else build 30 new homes on the plot of land. Janet Unruh as a Gresham resident. Unruh explains some of the dilemma with developing the land.
There's a little forest there next to a wetlands area, but it's a part of a chain of wetlands and forests. So the wetlands are like a headwaters to a couple of rivers in our area and eventually feed out to the Columbia River. And it's vital for these areas to remain intact for the migratory birds on their stopover, on their migrations. And the neighbors are quite upset, too. They felt blindsided by the plans, and many have said that they moved to the area because of the beautiful forest and just being close to nature. I see all the building going on around this area, and there's a lot of it that disturbs me. But this one is so close to this area that is supportive of all this different kind of biodiversity, and I just feel that we can't continue to take bites out of nature and expect that climate change will somehow take care of itself.
Not only is it a wetland that feeds two nearby rivers, the land has a forest of 267 trees that would be cut down, and neighbors are concerned about what the development would mean for them. John Blidsoe is the vice president of the Coalition of Gresham Neighborhoods. He explains.
The portion of the property that's developable is now approximately 3.5 or 4 acres of forest land. He would have to cut down most of that forest in order to put in 30 tightly packed homes. It's very awkward for the people to have to drive by that huge sign now and see, the imminent destruction of something that they've really cherished for themselves and for future generations, frankly. This is not what you would call a wealthy suburb of the greater Portland metro area. This is a working class neighborhood. It's surrounded on most sides by single family homes, middle class homes, and some apartment complexes. So there's not much room around here to build a park after this area is cut off.
There is hope, however, for those who would seek to preserve the plot of land from development. The city of Gresham is running a survey through Monday, April 26th, where residents can vote to support different parks projects, and the Shaw property purchase is one of them. We've heard comments from Gresham residents Janet Unruh and John Blidsoe. We've been talking about their efforts to preserve the Shaw property by having the city of Gresham buy it to preserve the forest and wetlands from development there. Their website on the topic is save267trees.org. For KBOO News, I'm Althea Billings.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Coming up next, at 5:30, it's Counterspin. At 6, it's Let's Talk About Race. Then at 7, it's Rising Up with Sauna Lee. Tonight, we'll see the end of our early spring dry spell. Rain will move in sometime after midnight, and temperatures will drop into the mid-40s. Tomorrow, we'll see a mostly rainy day with moderate winds and highs in the low to mid-50s. On this day in 1516, Duke Wilhelm IV instituted the Reinheitsgebot, the German beer purity law, which stated that beer sold in Bavaria can only be brewed from three ingredients: water, malt, and hops. Today's quote is from Abraham Lincoln, who said, quote, "I am a firm believer in the people. If given the truth, they can be depended on to meet any national crisis. The great point is to bring them the real facts and beer." Yesterday, Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley introduced a proposal to lower prescription drug prices to a level similar to those seen in other high-income countries. Merkley hopes to have the pricing regulations included in the Biden administration's upcoming American Families Plan. The plan also includes family leave, child care, and extended child tax credits, and the president is expected to lay out the details before his address to Congress next Wednesday. Merkley's plan would require the Secretary of Health and Human Services to set price caps for prescription drugs at the average retail list price in 11 other countries, including Japan, Germany, the United Kingdom, France, Italy, Canada, Australia, Spain, the Netherlands, Switzerland, and Sweden. In his comments, the Oregon senator referenced a man in Douglas County whose daughter relies on a seizure medication that costs $45,000 a vial in the United States, compared with $200 in Canada. Merkley told reporters, quote, "We have allowed Americans to be ripped off for far too long. It's an issue that no matter whether if I'm in a blue county or a purple county or a red county, citizens want us to address it." He also dismissed the industry claim that price caps would slow the development and availability of pharmaceuticals in the United States, saying, quote, "Their research budgets pale to their advertising budgets." Oregon lawmakers are also considering a plan to have state regulators set upper limits on prescription drug prices. Senate Bill 844 has bipartisan sponsorship and is currently in the Ways and Means Committee. While Joe Biden was committing the United States to cut its greenhouse gas emissions in half by 2030, climate activist Greta Thunberg was urging the U.S. to drop fossil fuel subsidies. And yesterday, the U.S. Senate passed a bill denouncing discrimination against Asian communities. Missouri Republican Josh Hawley was the only no vote. With more on these stories and others, here's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
No nation can solve this crisis on our own.
President Joe Biden announced a bold goal at day one of a virtual climate summit with 40 world leaders.
The United States sets out on the road to cut greenhouse gases in half by the end of this decade.
Meanwhile, at a House hearing on the impact of fossil fuels on climate change, 18-year-old Swedish activist Greta Thunberg chided the U.S. over fossil fuel subsidies and called on U.S. leaders to step up their efforts to cut carbon emissions.
We, the young people, are the ones who are going to write about you in the history books. We are the ones who get to decide how you will be remembered. So my advice for you is to choose wisely.
Republicans vowed to fight Biden's plans to shift to renewable energy from coal and fossil fuels. In the Senate, Republicans unveiled their counteroffer to the president's $2.3 trillion American Jobs Plan. Mississippi Republican Roger Wicker says their $568 billion plan is more narrowly focused just on physical infrastructure.
We take the part of the president's plan that most Americans agree is real hard infrastructure. We give it our touch, and we think we have a very good number here.
Biden wants a corporate tax rate of 28% to help pay for infrastructure, but the GOP plan would preserve the 2017 corporate tax rate of 21%. A bill denouncing discrimination against Asian communities passed the Senate on Thursday. Here's the bill's sponsor, Democrat Mazie Hirono of Hawaii.
As important as the content and substance of the bill is the message of this bill that we in the Senate are going to stand with our AAPI community and indeed any community that is discriminated against on the basis of race or any of the categories that you and I can think of.
Missouri Republican Josh Hawley, the lone dissenting vote, argued the bill was too broad. Four Republican amendments did not make it into the legislation, including one restricting federal funding for colleges that discriminate against Asian Americans in admissions. The House passed a D.C. statehood bill, but not without controversy. Democrat Mondaire Jones of New York accused Republicans of using racist arguments against statehood, sparking an eruption in the chamber.
One of my House Republican colleagues said that D.C. shouldn't be a state because the district doesn't have a landfill. My goodness, with all the racist trash my colleagues have brought to this debate, I can see why they're worried about having a place to put it.
Republicans immediately demanded that Jones' words be struck, and the freshman congressman agreed. The bill faces an uphill battle for Senate passage, which would likely require ending the filibuster. Federal prosecutors expect to charge at least 100 more people in connection with the January 6 riot at the U.S. Capitol. 400 people have already been charged in what will likely be one of the largest prosecutions in American history. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
First Lady Jill Biden reconfirmed the administration's commitment to improved tribal relations, and tribal leaders in Montana have united in opposition to the state-sponsored bison bill. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribal leaders and conservation groups sent a letter to Montana's governor this week urging him to veto two bison management bills. Yellowstone Public Radio's Caitlin Nicholas reports.
The leaders of the Fort Peck Assiniboine and Sioux tribes, the Fort Belknap Indian Community, and Blackfeet Nation, along with the Intertribal Buffalo Council, Defenders of Wildlife, and other conservation groups, say the two bison bills will threaten tribal efforts to restore bison through, quote, the unlawful delegation of state powers and the restrictive definition of wild bison, end quote. House Bill 302, which would give county commissioners authority to approve or deny bison transfers, is opposed by tribal nation leaders who say the bill contradicts Montana statutes and sets a, quote, dangerous precedent for fish and wildlife management, end quote.
It's kind of an attack on tribal sovereignty.
That's Irvin Carlson from Blackfeet Nation, president of the Intertribal Buffalo Council. While supporters in the bill's hearings said it gives locals impacted by bison transfers more authority, tribal members and leaders said it would ultimately make acquiring bison more difficult or even impossible for tribes.
Does the county commissioners have any expertise in wildlife management, or do they have any, you know, biologists on a commission or wildlife managers who can actually give a real reason why they shouldn't come in? We don't think so. It's just more of a political decision that's going to be made.
The letter also asked Governor Gianforte to veto House Bill 318, which would define domestic bison as animals that have ever been subject to a per capita livestock fee. Opponents say the new definition ensures very few bison in Montana will qualify as wild bison, which they say would constrain tribal, state, and federal efforts to supplement conservation herds. Earlier this week, Gianforte announced the cancellation of a bison management plan that would have allowed more bison to be restored across the state. In Montana, for National Native News, I'm Caitlin Nicholas.
The First Lady of the United States says the Biden administration is committed to respecting tribal sovereignty and working to strengthen relationships with tribes. The remarks were made during an outdoor speech at the Navajo Nation Capitol in Arizona Thursday. First Lady Jill Biden says tribes will always have a voice in the administration.
Today, as your First Lady, in our first 100 days, I am here to let you know that we are keeping that promise. We stand with you, the Navajo Nation. As you govern, our administration will work in partnership with you, honoring the solemn trust responsibility to tribal nations.
Some initiatives she touted for Indian Country during President Biden's first 100 days in office include the reestablishment of the White House Council on Native American Affairs, COVID-19 relief, and key Native American members, including Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland, and the nomination of Brian Newland for Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs. The First Lady says the administration is just getting started, adding their proposed plans in the works, which seek job creation and to address broadband and infrastructure needs. Her visit on Navajo land continues Friday to a school and a vaccination clinic. This is her third trip to the Navajo Nation, according to the tribe, but the first as First Lady. Tribal groups are calling for the swift confirmation of Brian Newland for Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs after his nomination was announced Thursday. Newland is a citizen of the Bay Mills Indian community and served as chairman and chief judge. He also served in the Obama administration. The National Congress of American Indians and the United South and Eastern Tribes applauded the announcement and are calling on the Senate to act quickly. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
This week, medical officials from BioNTech and Pfizer, the companies that jointly developed one of the vaccines, confirmed that yearly booster shots of the Pfizer vaccine will be required to maintain immunity. On Wednesday, Dr. Özlem Türesi, co-founder and chief medical officer of BioNTech, said that scientists expect vaccine-induced immunity against the virus and emerging variants will diminish over time. Pfizer stated earlier this month that their vaccine is over 91% effective at protecting against COVID-19 and more than 95% effective against severe disease up to 6 months after vaccination. The Moderna vaccine uses technology that is similar to Pfizer's and is also expected to remain highly effective for up to 6 months after the initial two doses are administered. Individuals who contracted COVID-19 and recovered also saw their natural immune response begin to decline after a number of months. Scientists have yet to determine how quickly immunity declines, but think that annual boosters for COVID may be required, similar to those for seasonal flu. Andy Slavitt, senior advisor to President Joe Biden's COVID response team, said last Friday that the administration had already begun preparing for the distribution of future vaccine booster doses. The demand for coronavirus vaccines has begun to dwindle in the U.S., and the Biden administration's chief medical advisor, Dr. Anthony Fauci, warns that the U.S. has not yet reached herd immunity, and hotspots are still popping up across the nation. It's estimated that 70 to 85% of the population would need to be fully immunized in the United States in order to achieve herd immunity and stop the spread of coronavirus. Currently, roughly half of the adult population in the U.S. has received at least one dose, with a third of the population being fully vaccinated. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, April 23rd, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158.